Building Bridges, your community and labor report, produced and hosted by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nash.
We're going to take a look at our nearest neighbor to the south that has certainly been a source of interest and concern for us, but we rarely look at the condition of workers and social protest movements in Mexico. So joining us now are Benjamin Anaya, an independent journalist, a muralist, Mexican activist, etc., and Daniel Labote, who is the editor of Mexican Labor News and Analysis. And with us in studio participating in this segment is Professor Manny Ness, author of The Extraordinary, the International Encyclopedia of Revolution and Protest.
Dan, let's start with you. In terms of the current crisis, Mexican workers, of course, have been suffering these long years. But how has the current economic crisis, which started in the United States, impacted on workers in Mexico?
Well, Mexico has just had a series of crises. A very conservative government without legitimacy. Then this economic crisis, which has led to plant closings, layoffs, shorter work weeks, many people suffering from the economic effects of that. The fall in the oil prices, which is one of the main products of Mexico, has also led to not only a fall in oil revenues, but also of taxes for the government. So that Mexico is facing a lot of economic problems, and many workers are suffering. Mexico already has a country where about 20% of people live in extreme poverty, about 40% of people in poverty. It already has a country where there's 3.5 million children between 6 and 14 who are working. It's a country where 10% of the population has already left to go to the United States to try to find employment they couldn't find in Mexico. So this economic crisis is having a devastating impact.
Dan, can you tell us a little bit about the labor unions, the independent unions, and also the government-run unions, the kinds of activities they're engaged in at this point in response to the crisis?
Mexico, historically, had government-controlled unions, had them for a long time, for about 70 years. And the ruling party controlled the unions, and workers had little opportunities to have any democratic voice in their union. Unions really served the government and then later served the companies. With the change from the pre to the pon, that is, with the election of Fox in 2000, there was some thought that there might be a change in this situation and that the old party-supported labor federations, the Congress of Labor and the Confederation of Mexican Workers and others, would collapse because they were so conservative, so corrupt, so bureaucratic, so unresponsive. But they didn't collapse. They survived, and the government reached out a hand to help them. So now you have the Republican Party of Mexico, the National Action Party, the PAN of President Felipe Calderón, is reaching out and supporting these former state unions of the PRI as they negotiate, you know, ghost unions that often negotiate protection contracts to protect the employer so they can say they have a union, but the union contract gives workers little. Since the mid-1990s, we've had a couple big independent labor federations in Mexico. We've had the National Union of Workers, the UNT, and we've had the Mexican Union Front, a big coalition of unions and other organizations. And those two groups act more independently, often really fight in workers' interests. And the first group of unions is more or less, that is the government unions, more or less accepts what the government and the employers want. It doesn't really lead a struggle in Mexico. Occasionally some branch or some local regional federation might, but it's the independent unions that are leading a fight saying that there has to be things like unemployment compensation in Mexico, that there have to be more jobs. Most important, they're saying they need a new kind of economy, not one based on neoliberalism, that is, conservative economic policies that benefit the employers, but rather a new reorganization of the economy to really benefit the Mexican people. So that's really the demand of the independent unions, and they march and demonstrate and fight for those things, carrying out strikes in Mexico, often inhibited by the government's labor boards and the Secretary of Labor. There are strikes, there are important struggles in Mexico, but it's often hard to carry them out because the law is usually used against workers.
And I want to bring Benjamin into the discussion, shifting for a moment. I mean, one of the reports that's come out with the allegations and the hysteria in some ways, or maybe the exploitation of the issue of drug use and abuse in Mexico, there has been reports of exacerbated clampdowns on human rights by the policing apparatus. And I wonder what you could tell us about that, Benjamin.
Some of the issues that other panelists there pointed are very real. But the fact that the economy has been broken twice in the last 20 years, and the world's tremendous increase of the drug consumption has also impacted the Mexican society. So a lot of young students and a lot of young people that has not regular opportunities to get into the labor market, they are many times facing the problem of the drug addiction, and at the same time, drug dealers and the cartels, the so-called cartels, traffickers, they got a lot of power, and they got a lot of attractive, mood, because, you know, some of the media takes a little role in this. Media spreads what we call in Spanish narcocultura, a narcoculture that is like so much attractive. How to get rich with a less effort. And a lot of people believes and really thinks that traffickers, the drug traffickers, are a real person that takes a little role in the society, bringing more opportunities than maybe the broken economy enterprises. At the same time, with the starting of the NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, some of the agreements that the industry takes with the big capital is not only to avoid responsibilities in the regular market of labor, as Social Security, as retirement funds, but they prefer to contract with free contractors with no social involvement, and with all those kind of situations, they prefer to enroll people just for part-time jobs or just like temporary jobs. So many of these people, this big market, this big amount of population that has no opportunities, they need to do something to survive. And at the same time, it's this combination between the narco-culture and the less opportunities for a lot of workers bring us very bad situation now in the Mexican economy.
Daniel, the critics of immigration in this country don't talk about the situation as we are now in Mexico. I know that you've written on this extensively and also have recently focused on the situation of a long-term strike in northern Mexico in the mine and steel industry. If you could give us a summary of that.
Can I add one word to Benjamin's comments about the drug issue? I mean, in response to the drug cartels, the government sent out 40,000 troops, militarization of much of Mexico, and with many abuses, including rapes, torture, murder, and so on. Human Rights Watch has a report on that up on its website now called Uniform Impunity, and that's a good resource to learn more about that. Regarding the miners, Grupo México, a big mining company in Mexico, the largest mining company, most important mining company there, has been trying to break the mine workers' union, particularly at its Cananea mine, but really they would like to get rid of the mine workers' union, which has become too independent. For a long time, it was a government-controlled union run by a typical corrupt bureaucrat named Napoleon Gomezada. When he died, his son, Napoleon Gomez Urrutia, became the head of the union. But the son, even though he inherited the union, decided he was going to fight and fight for workers and led a series of strikes that won higher wages, almost double the wages that other workers got. And he also created alliances with mine workers in the United States and Peru and with the International Metal Workers Federation. And he tried to change the Congress of Labor. He tried to turn the Congress of Labor into a different kind of organization, fought for the leadership there. That's what really got him in trouble with the government. So he was, and then he made the comment after February 19th, 2006, when the Pasta de Conchos mine disaster took place and 65 Mexican mine workers died, he made the comment that this was industrial homicide. So his fight to change the Congress of Labor and his comment about industrial homicide turned him into public enemy number one from the point of view of the government and Grupo México. So the mine workers, however, wanted to control their union and have been fighting to keep him in the union. He was accused of embezzling $55 million. Independent groups from the United Steelworkers and the Metalworkers Federation and others do not believe he did this. They've conducted audits. They believe he didn't do that. He has subsequently gone and led the union from Vancouver, British Columbia for 2 years, and the workers in the union have been conducting an amazing battle, really a two-year strike at Cananea, strikes at many other mines, huge strikes in the steel plants in Lázaro Cárdenas, Michoacán. So you have a union that's really been embattled for 2 years, and now there's really an attempt once again to crush this union. There have been many legal efforts. They've tried to replace him with other union leaders and put other people in charge of the union. They've tried to create company unions. They have fired, occasionally declared the strike illegal, and then it gets declared legal again. They've attempted to fire. Now they've fired all the workers at the Cananea mine. It's very interesting, in light of the swine flu, that at this very moment, while this titanic battle is going on between the mine workers and Grupo México and the government, and the Mexican government said there should be no non-essential work taking place, and yet Grupo México, in defiance of the government's request, is operating its mines, showing it has no more regard for public health than it does for the miners' safety or for their rights.
Benjamin, I want to shift just a little bit, because one of the things that we have covered, certainly at this station, is the extraordinary perseverance, creativity, and aggressiveness of the Oaxaca teachers, who really were shining in their example of their uniting a kind of community workplace struggle, representing the interests in a fundamental way of the student populace there, etc. And of course, we've looked at some of the Zapatista battles as well. Catch us up on, or give us a sense of, what the resistance of the Mexican people, whether it's in those venues or other areas, are to some of the terribly oppressive economic conditions, the corruption of the policing apparatus, and to very many of the province's governments.
Called Comuna of Oaxaca, that happens in 2006 to 2007 almost. During all that year, that was in which we in Mexico celebrated the elections. It's not only responding the Comuna of Oaxaca to just a lapse of the history. Oaxaca has an heritage of two big thinkers. One is Benito Juarez, the first indigenous president in Latin America, and the other one is the brothers Ricardo and Enrique Flores Magón. They were anarchists. They founded the Labor Party, and they were they play a prominent role in the Mexican Revolution, being the intelligentsia of the Zapata program. During the revolution, the brothers Flores Magón, they were kidnapped. They were on jail in the U.S. They were very interesting guerrilla. But the most important thing is they recover in their thinking, in their writings, something very important, that the people don't need party. What the people need is the communal organization. The Indian tribes and the Indian nations in Mexico, there in Oaxaca, there are like 22 different languages and variations different tribes, different nations of indigenous people. They believe that the comuna is the natural form of organization. So what the Flores Magón pointed into the Mexican Revolution was the importance of being organized as a people without any kind of party. And then a lot of professors, teachers in Oaxaca, they recovered that point of view, including another ones that they prefer more to be focalized on the Marxism, Leninism, and other leftist ways to understand the reality. But I think that form of organization led to the Popular Assembly of the Peoples of Oaxaca, the APO, to organize a comuna, a resistance comuna, in which all the people, including professors, workers, students, people from the market, they were, without taking off their own identities as a community, as groups or collectives, they participated in a big protest against a lot of struggles that have been happened since like the end of the revolution. So the Comuna Oaxaca brought to the world a very interesting fact. In the same way that the Comuna of Paris, they really tried to organize, and for sure with the paramilitary and with the military forces, they've been repressed with a lot of people killed, a lot of abuses, a lot of rapes, and the forms that Pinochet in Chile improved and planned to, you know, to face the opposition. The governor that is also not well accepted, governor Ulises Ruiz, he uses the same methods as Pinochet. So now the professors and the APPO, the Popular Assembly of the Peoples of Oaxaca, they are reorganizing the movement, maybe not using the same strategies as like to make the protest or the rallies just on the streets, but they are using another kind of ways, more focused on the local villages, trying to make more autonomous municipalities.
What I'd like to know from both of you, just briefly, if you could tell and have some influence with President Obama, what should be the response to our relationship with Mexico? What do we need to tell them, tell him about economically, about immigration-based issues? What would both of you suggest are the critical issues? And why don't we start again with Benjamin and wind up with Danielle?
Well, President Obama, I think he has a big responsibility because Mexico is waiting a lot from him. The Mexican economy has been broken by corruption. We have in Mexico, we have the last year's first, the richest man in the world, Carlos Slim. And he and all the elite in the politics, they decide to keep on the NAFTA trade as it is. I mean, getting richer, the richest people, and poor, going to the decadence to many different aspects of the economical society. Decadence in terms not only in less opportunities, but decadence in terms of what we can see. The family is broken, the phenomena of immigration to North America and to another cities, and at the same time, the replacement of the Mexican traditional organization from the people and values towards narco control in the country, and the control of the economy by traffic dealers and the narco gangsters is very hard. So what we need to set up in terms of facing relationship with the Barack Obama is a common effort. Barack Obama needs to understand that the traffic dealers are responding to a policy that has been applied during the Republican Party. They support all the production, control production on drugs, and so the cartels, the all the elite of the narco-traffickers, they are expecting all the time that the enrichment, all the time they are expecting more and more and more consumption because a lot of people is addicted now to the drugs. So the first issue is try to set on the agenda between Obama and Mexico counterparts is to understand, first of all, that the problem is a shared problem. Drugs are affecting both societies. It's an industry. It's not just an isolated case. It's a full industry that is bringing a lot of resources and a lot of incomes to the Mexican economy. And the other fact is I think Obama don't need to face in the same way that supposedly George W. Bush faced up the problem with Mexico, that is, with a lot of military, with a barrier in the frontier. And now I think they need to understand that it's not with military forces, that they, most of the time, they are also demanding drugs. There are a lot of problems about it. So I think the most important to Barack Obama is understand that economy must turn, that maybe includes, I expect, and the people from Mexico are expecting, that including people, the immigrant workers here in the U.S., that are people that really want to work, and it not only are not parasites of the society, they are workers, hard workers, including them as a part of temporary part of this of the economy, maybe, but maybe with a full reform on immigration. Maybe
let me just interrupt you just in order to also bring and just give one last word, simile to Danielle, in tandem with what Benjamin Anyana has been saying. What is your perspective?
Obama. Barack Obama has already indicated that he continues Bush's policies in Mexico. He's gone to Mexico and praised Felipe Calderon as a wonderful leader there. He supports his military efforts. He is giving more funds through Plan Merida. He is in every way, Janet Napolitano is going to strengthen the border fence and so on. That is, it's not a question of what we say to Barack Obama, who is indicating by continuing the war in Iraq, in Afghanistan, expanding it to Pakistan. Barack Obama is defending the same corporate interests. What we have to say is, how are we going to build an alliance of social movements across the border? We have to build movements, organizations, and build power of people across the border. We have to support struggles on both sides of Mexican people there, of immigrants here, and of all working people and all oppressed people in both countries. I think it's what we do. It's not what we say to Barack Obama. Barack Obama has made pretty clear in Mexico he's not changing the policy there. He represents the corporate interests in the long run, and I think it would be a mistake to say that our job is to advise him.
Well, Daniel Lavoz and Benjamin Anyana, I thank you very much for joining us on this May Day, and we'll have to talk more frequently because we have to learn a lot more and build some of those relationships on a much more immediate and close level than we have with our southern neighbor, Mexico. And again, Daniel Lavoz is editor of Mexican Labor News and Analysis, and Benjamin Anyana is an independent journalist, a muralist, activist. I think you heard it all.
Great to be with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
700 miles across the border to the States, with a plastic bottle running across the desert in the shake. Come to English-only country, hiding from the Minutemen. Come to make this place my home, run a long, long way from there. Story of a lifetime for the minimum wage. Well, they chased me through the desert, then the agent strapped me down. Then they asked me why in Spanish, why you keep on coming back. Well, I left my dad in Jersey and my sisters in Vermont. They've been working in this country, picking lettuce, washing floors. Story of a lifetime for the minimum wage. Well, they raised me to $1, 'cause I washed the dishes fast. Well, the boss, he got me working on the porch and in the bed. Then I wash the dish and rinse it. Then I go home late and sleep. Well, I need to be awake now, 'cause I walk out in my sleep. When I see that black van coming, well, I know I'm sure to run. God damn, the major caught me, caught me on the spot. Minimum wage.
Lila Downs with Minimum Wage.
I like that.
Yeah, I thought it tied into all that we have been looking at. Well, this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our new website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.